The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott.
What did you print out for me?
Oh, well, somewhere I was reading about frost.
You may not expect to encounter poetry at the New Hampshire Department of Transportation, but when we visited Bill Boynton, Director of Public Information at the DOT, this week, we were exploring something that inspired him to read aloud from Robert Frost's classic poem, Mending Wall.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it, and spills the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast.
That something that we were after, and that Robert Frost describes as something there doesn't love a wall, has been given another name, a Frosteve. No pun intended.
Well, they look like bumps in the road, round mounds in the road.
It's frost causing the road to heave up.
Frost is heaving.
When water gets cold, it turns into ice and expands. It's physics.
And we all know that when soil is saturated with water and then it freezes, it has to go somewhere and it goes up.
Anybody that drives on them knows what that feels like. The road literally heaves upward and has spots where it's a very rough ride, where your head can hit the ceiling of the vehicle.
It can be treacherous, and you can lose the whole bottom of your car if you hit one wrong and you're going too fast.
We've had a bitter cold start to this new year, so we've got a bit of an icy theme on the show today. And we're going to be spending a lot of it on the road, encountering those problematic, yet, as it turns out, surprisingly poetic speed bumps that we call Frosteves. Yeah, Frosteves. And no, we haven't run out of ideas. We're trying to answer this question from a listener named Jean for our Only in New Hampshire series. Now, Jean is originally from the Midwest, where there is plenty of cold, but she had never heard of a Frosteve. So she asked us to find out where the term comes from and whether it is unique to New Hampshire. Producer Justine Paradise called her up.
So I moved to New Hampshire in 2012 in August, and as winter rolled around, my first winter on the East Coast, I started seeing signs for frost heaves, and that's something I'd never seen before. And then, of course, you know, driving on New Hampshire roads, you do experience them. I also bought a house in Nottingham last year, and I have a frost heave on my driveway.
Oh, do you really?
I do, yes. It's a very minimal bump, but I have noticed that, you know, it's something that seems to be exacerbated by the rapid thawing and freezing.
And yeah, what made you wonder or suspect, I guess, that the phenomenon was unique to New Hampshire? Because, yeah, what made you suspect that?
You know, it was funny, your email prompted me to go back to Facebook, and I see that, you know, in December of 2012, I had posted a photo of one of these signs. And yeah, my friends and family from the Midwest and elsewhere kind of chimed in saying how unusual that was.
Ah.
Yeah, so I'd love to be able to go back to this Facebook post and update everybody about the origins of the term.
That was listener Jean Sokowowski, who got us started on this today and really got Word of Mouth producer Justine Paradise going. Hello, Justine.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me in.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. So, first of all, were you able to answer this question? What is the origin of the term Frosteve?
So, I have a theory. When I first got this question, I thought that the answer would be pretty easy, like because we have such a strong relationship with snow and ice, and that's something that affects daily life here for, you know, over half the year. But what I found was that even though there was a lot of research in Frosteves, scientific research in Frosteves, the term didn't really come up in older literature. So I thought that I would just try to find the very first instance of a mention of Frosteves. And I found this document, Historic Perspectives in Frosteve Research, that assembled all of these, the numerous papers on Frosteves there are in the world, where there actually are quite a few. And the very first reference to it was in 1694 by this Swedish geologist and chemist, Urban Hjern. I don't actually speak Swedish, so I don't really know if I'm pronouncing this right.
We'll let that one go.
Urban Hjern in 1694, and he mentions this idea of earth heaving or earth shooting, and also of needle ice, which, have you ever gone hiking in an icy weather and seen the frozen ground around you? And there's this phenomenon that sometimes you see where you see sort of needle ice.
Oh, those sort of really thin little strands all packed together.
Yeah, it's kind of beautiful. It looks almost like yarn or something.
Or
I mean, really like needles. It's very exquisite, and they are like little towers. And often they'll have little particles of soil on the top because they've pushed through the soil up and out. And that's actually a miniature example of frost heave. So he mentions that as well in this paper. But he doesn't refer to it as frost heave.
But heave is such a, you know, dramatic kind of word, the earth heaving upwards. Did you find any evidence or references to something like frost heaves from those early New England settlers, you know, the Puritans?
You know, not that I found, but what I did find when I was learning about frost heaves is the early settlers would have arrived to woods. And frost heaves are exacerbated when the land gets cleared because tree roots hold soil and rocks into place, so the ground contracts and expands as one. But when you clear the trees, as the ice lenses form under boulders and slowly push them up, they're more easily able to get loose and come up to the surface, and frost heaves are more possible and would have happened more frequently as land got developed. I kind of picture it like seltzer water, like boulders bubbling up from the earth. But really, when things started to change, I think, was when highways and roads started to get paved over and cars started to pass over these roads. And it was right around when Robert Frost wrote Mending Wall in 1914 that started to happen. And there was a lot of interest in road paving and in highways and research being invested into it. There were a bunch of highway magazines that began. And in the Good Roads Journal around 1915, there's reference to frost action and when frost leaves or enters the ground. So we're getting closer and closer to this term. And finally, this seminal paper is published in 1929 by this guy named Stephen Tabor, a professor at the University of South Carolina, and it's called Frost Heaving. And from then on, I think people refer to it as frost heaves, and this is my theory. Because that's when I see the strongest example. And from then on, people just refer to it as frost heaves in all the literature.
But like the question that was asked, we don't see signs for frost heaves in other places. I mean, why did New Hampshire adopt it? Do you have any idea?
You know, I wanted to check to see if really it was just in New Hampshire. And my first instinct was probably not. You know, this is a phenomenon that wherever it's cold, you're going to have this happening. And frost heave has been documented on Mars when the Phoenix lander landed in 2008. They landed on a frost heave site. So anyhow, it is more than global. It's extraterrestrial as well. But I still thought that maybe there was something about New Hampshire that is specific because we do have all of those signs. And, you know, when Jean posted this to Facebook, like she mentioned, her friends and family said how unusual it was. So I called the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and when I called them, the guy I talked to had actually never heard of frost heaves.
You're kidding, in Minnesota?
I know. And
with all that Swedish heritage?
I know. And eventually, as we were talking, he said, we do experience that sometimes, but we mostly experience these other phenomena, pavement buckling that happens in the summer. There's a whole world of highway problems, so we don't have to go too far into that.
But is there something about the geology of New Hampshire that is different than Minnesota that makes frost heaves possible?
I actually think the best way to answer that question is to get out there into the natural habitat of frost heaves and get on the road.
Hit it.
Before I knew it, I was winding my way down the back roads of the Lake District, passing signs for fresh eggs and the occasional ancient sugar maple by a classic red barn. I'd headed up towards Holderness, where I'd heard I might find some frost heaves. And it's actually the stomping grounds of a scholar of New Hampshire's roads.
So my middle name is Tink, T-I-N-K, Malcolm Tink Taylor.
Yeah, where'd that come from?
My grandfather gave it to me. He was British, and it comes from the old British poem, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Sailor, Poor Man, Beggar Man. So Tinker got dropped to Tink somewhere when I was about 3 and have not been able to shake it.
Tink is officially retired now, but he's had a long career in policy and transportation. He served in the legislature, he was town meeting moderator where he lives in Holderness, and he still serves on local and state transportation planning committees.
Very interested in rail and in transportation in general. Those are sort of my first loves, and I still spend a lot of time doing that.
His work with transportation and planning is clearly more than just a job for him. If I'm a novice Frosteve hunter, Tink Taylor is a professional.
I have some photographs of Frosties you would not believe. I carry this little Mickey Mouse camera with me everywhere I go, and I see a real bad Frostie. If I jump out, my wife puts on the double flashes, and she looks both ways, and I get out on the road, and I get down low, and I take a picture of it, and I show it to people, and they just say, oh, it can't be that bad. And they do look very dramatic when you get down at the same level of an automobile. It's one thing to stand up and shoot down, and I've got pictures of Frosties with water bubbling out of the ground, and there's one picture I have that shows a frost heave, and sometimes I'll wait until a car comes along, and I have this car going over the frost heave, and then the car stops, and the driver gets out. He's down on his hands and knees looking under his car, all of which reminds me of the guy at the body shop. Saying, oh, yes. Yeah, that's a real problem.
So we got a listener question. How and when did the term frost heaves originate, and is the phenomenon unique to New Hampshire? You know, it's sort of clear that it's not unique to New Hampshire, but could it be worse in New Hampshire than in other regions, I'm wondering?
So I can't give you the exact derivation of it, but it pretty well describes the phenomenon. It pretty well tells you what's happening. Frost is heaving. And we all know that when soil is saturated with water and then it freezes, it has to go somewhere and it goes up. And so the frost heaves occur on highways, and occur on as you enter into a bridge. And in the old days, some may even remember when the highways were made out of concrete, and they were made in sections, slabs of concrete. And every time you went from one to the other, you went ka-thump, ka-thump, ka-thump. And in a way, that was a little bit of frost heaving, because one slab would heave and the other slab next to it wouldn't, because there wasn't enough moisture under it. So even today, you can be driving over a blacktop highway and you can still hear the ker-thump, ker-thump, because they've laid the blacktop over concrete slabs.
Well, I guess I'm curious, why do you think that someone might think that the phenomenon is unique to New Hampshire, that the frost heaves are unique to New Hampshire?
Well, they probably haven't driven Vermont this time of the year. They haven't driven in Maine during the dead of winter. Mm. We have friends live in Minnesota. They have some problem there, but the terrain is a little different. When you move out of northern New England, you get terrain that is sort of straightaway, flat. But when you get into New Hampshire and into Vermont, you've got these craggy old mountains and exposed ledge, and you've got a lot of subterranean water sources. We have a lot of water in New Hampshire, and a lot of it is underground, and a lot of it is traveling underground. And that's what contributes to the heaving. So the lay of the land, I think, is a lot to say about it. I think the kinds of repairs they're doing and how rapidly they do the repairs are probably the difference between the state. New Hampshire is always struggling to catch up. It's always a struggle to try to catch up with needed maintenance.
Well, you talked a little bit about sort of the history of New Hampshire roads. Like, some of them must be really old.
Oh, yes, and many of them follow the ancient Indian trails.
So if you dug down, you'd find?
You don't know what you're going to find. You might find old wheels. You might find some logs. They were laid down centuries ago, and today we follow the same winding paths up and down, and dipsy doodles in and out and around. And there's a reluctance to straighten them out. What you need is you need permeable layers of crushed stone and gravel, and even sand in some cases, that allows the moisture to drain away from the road. But what happens is, under so many of our highways, the moisture is trapped. It can't go anywhere. The best-built roads are built from the bottom up. You don't build highways from the top down. You build them from the bottom up.
But it's expensive to rebuild a road from the bottom up. So instead, Tink Taylor says that as a temporary fix, repair crews will often lay a thin layer of asphalt or a shim coat over the damage.
It's so pretty out here. The sun is setting, it's like sort of lemony yellow through the trees, which are all bare.
As I drive deeper into the woods of the Lakes District, continuing on my quest in pursuit of the Wild Frost Heave, I start to think that maybe I'm driving down one of the roads that Tink Taylor mentioned. Because even though I can see evidence of repairs, I'm still feeling some echoes of Frost Heave's past.
All right. Yeah, this is pretty uneven, and I can see that there's... Ooh! The bumpiness has knocked some ice off the top of the car, which is now falling.
I wondered, just how expensive is it to fully repair a road, do the job once and for all, and rebuild it from the bottom up? I asked Bill Boynton, reader of Robert Frost and director of public information at the New Hampshire Department of Transportation.
Well, when we talk about maintaining and preserving roads, you can spend $50,000 to $100,000 to resurface or pave a road and keep it in good condition. Once it fails, you're looking at $1 million a mile in order to rebuild a road, in some cases even more.
$50,000 to $100,000 to fix a mile of okay road versus $1 million to completely redo a failed road. That is a huge difference, 10 to 20 times more expensive.
When you're talking 4,600 miles of state road, that's a pretty prohibitive price tag when we're trying to keep the existing system operating with roads and bridges. So while we oftentimes will go in and rebuild certain corridors, major corridors, to try to improve them, a lot of the secondary roads, we have 900 miles of unnumbered state roads. A lot of those roads are going to basically remain in that type of condition, at least under the surface, indefinitely, as we try to at least maintain a good riding surface.
But there's still the question of the signs for Frost Heave that Gene saw. So I called around and I learned that New Hampshire is not the only state to post signs for Frost Heave. Minnesota doesn't do it because they don't really have that issue. But in Vermont, at least, the state posts signs that warn against both frost heaves and a more general bump. So we're not the only ones. But while I'm at the New Hampshire Department of Transportation, Bill's colleague Caleb Dobbins, who's New Hampshire's state highway maintenance engineer, pokes his head in for a bit, and I can't resist asking him.
How many signs do you put out every year?
Oh, that's a number I couldn't even count. We look at the severity of the frost heave and how numerous they are in a specific spot. I mean, there is not a frost heave sign for every frost heave in New Hampshire on the state roads. We would run out of time and signs for sure.
Would it be in the hundreds, the thousands?
Oh, I would say easily in the thousands.
One answer I give to people about, you know, why does New Hampshire, again, have so many, and it gets back to that fluctuating around the freezing degree mark. I grew up in northern Maine, and it wasn't unusual to be 20 below for weeks at a time, and it was very unusual to have conditions, spring-like conditions, in January or February. So if it's frozen all the time or not fluctuating, then you're less likely to get this phenomena where you're getting the freeze-thaw cycle and the disruption under the surface of the road. So whether it's our geography or our history and our climate, all of those lend themselves to being a haven for frost heaves.
So the combination of moody New England temperatures, old roads, craggy geology, and highway costs all suggest a certain inevitability when it comes to frost heaves. But it's one thing to say frost heaves are inevitable. I want to know what it's like to live with it. So I pay a visit to Don Brown at the Corner House Inn, a restaurant and pub in Center Sandwich.
Hey, Don, how are you? Nice to meet you.
It's a cozy spot with a hint of the upscale, and we sit down in one of the dining rooms while Don lights a fire.
Okay, is that a little propane fireplace?
Yeah. It's a real fireplace, but we put propane logs in it a few years back.
To get to the Corner House, you typically have to drive down Route 113, a hilly, winding, and often frost-heave-ridden road. I probably took it around 30 miles an hour and still experienced a little turbulence. But Don says that just a couple years ago, it was in worse shape.
Anytime you ran into virtually anyone, whether it was at the post office or at the
coffee shop. I mean, that was just the conversation that everyone was talking about. I used to refer to it almost similar to mogul skiing, because you had to drive around all these big frost heaves just like you were going down a course.
Don's been running the corner house for 37 years in Sandwich, so he's no stranger to the New England seasons. But this was different.
Usually frost heaves appear around February and they last for a month or so, and then they eventually go away as the ground thaws. And what had happened is that the roads had taken such a beating over the years and were lacking the necessary maintenance. So those frost heave conditions existed year round.
Don's restaurant, like a lot of businesses in the Lake District, is seasonal. He relies on the extra revenue from summer visitors. So when customers started remarking on the bumpy roads in July, he got worried.
They just couldn't believe it, and they'd say, oh my gosh, what's going on with your roads? We're not coming back because it's just beating up our cars too much.
Do you think people really didn't come back because of the frost heaves?
I think it gave them reason to think twice about heading our direction, sure. I mean, there's a lot of options for people these days, so if you give them any reason at all to think twice about coming, it's not a good thing.
The worst of this was a couple years ago, and Don says that since then, the DOT has fixed up some of the roads. But again, not in that bottom-up, long-term way. The roads might be in better shape now, but the question is, how long will that last?
Ooh, I'm going too fast.
It's dark as I leave the corner house and set off back west towards the smooth tarmac of 93. And the drive does feel a little longer this time as I wind my way through the hills by my headlights. And I notice something that I didn't before.
All right, coming to the end of the road. See the lights of Holderness. All right. And at the end of that drive is an auto repair shop.
Well, moral of the story, where there are frost heaves, there are auto repair shops, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Justine, you went much deeper into frost heaves than I have ever gone. So first of all, thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
But part of your interest originally was about the language, calling something a frost heave, which is, I guess, happens pretty much only here in New Hampshire. So what did you come up with there?
Yeah, well, I think the word is really poetic to me. And I think part of the reason that I'm interested in this is the more specific you get about vocabulary, about landscape, I think there's sometimes a relationship between naming something and knowing it. You can liken it to color, where if you look at a sky, there's the sky is blue, but you can get more specific and say, oh, that's all of these different shades of blue. So this is actually an idea that I got from reading Robert McFarlane's book, Landmarks. Robert McFarlane is this British author. He writes about words and landscape. And what he did was he gathered all of these tiny little landscape words from all over England that came from these little hamlets and counties all over the place. Like, for instance, there are all these different words for icicle all over the British Isles that are so evocative and beautiful and poetic.
What are some of them?
Well, I'll open it up and tell you. For instance, aquabob is used in Kent for icicle. Clinkerbell and dagler in Wessex.
Oh, clinkerbell?
Clinkerbell. Cancervel in Exmoor. Ickle in Yorkshire, and a couple others, Tankle in Durham and Shuckle in Cumbria.
Those are kind of sweet words.
Yeah. And
they're
so
cute.
They are. And, you know, I thought that I wondered what it meant that frost heave is something that we relate to so much in New Hampshire, even though it's not the only place you find them. It is a place that really identifies with them. And I thought that maybe it had something to do with the fact that we're able to live with something that's like a little imperfect, that's something that we can endure here.
Well, that's such a New England thing in a way, right? That the thing that is the obstacle, you just kind of ride over it. Or the old barn that's falling in your property, you just let it go.
Yeah, and you kind of celebrate it or make a joke of it. So I ended up reaching out to Robert McFarlane because he's on Twitter. And I asked him, because he's this gatherer of words and specific vocabulary and ice terms, I thought he would know what the origin of frost heaves might be. And he had never heard of it.
And that's producer Justine Paradise coming to the end of the Frost Heaven Road, at least until spring. But we're not getting off the road just yet. We're going to hear about some alternatives to road salt that won't harm New Hampshire's lakes or streams or your car.
High fructose corn syrup has been used, molasses, beer waste, distillery waste, cheese waste, beet waste.
It's an all-you-can-drive buffet right after the break. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. Last year, the New Hampshire Department of Transportation dumped some 225,000 tons of salt on the state's roads. Ted Deer says that number is probably just a quarter of the overall road salt put down. Cities, towns, plow trucks, and the public probably bring the number closer to 1 million tons. And Ted would know. He's administrator for the Watershed Management Bureau at DES. Basically, he is responsible for the water quality in New Hampshire's lakes and rivers. He's also head of the Green Snowplow Certification Program, which is aimed at lowering our salt usage. Hello, Ted.
Hey, good morning.
A lot of big jobs there.
Thanks.
Especially this time of year.
Yeah, it is a challenge.
Well, I'm told that New Hampshire is the first state to use road salt. Is that true?
Yeah, it's one of those interesting quirks of history. We are obviously a snowy place. And sometime back in the 1930s, our Department of Transportation got the idea to start using sodium chloride, that is rock salt, on our roads. And so they have these great pictures, and I encourage people, if they have any on their website or whatever, to go and take a look where there's some poor guy standing in the back of a truck shoveling salt as the truck goes down the road. We have come a long ways.
What did we do before then?
So before that, roads were rolled. So if there's interesting pictures that you see where there's these giant rollers. They were like 10-foot diameter rollers.
Like cement roller kind of things?
Yeah, kind of like that, but horse-drawn or oxen-drawn. Going down the road, and they would just press the snow down, and people drove on top of it. There were plows early on. There were people used, chains on their tires. It's not that long ago that every person just about in New Hampshire had a box of chains in their trunk. So, what you've seen over time is that we've changed as the technology has changed and as the need for speed has changed as well. And so during the winter, we tend to go faster than we probably did 50 years ago.
Yeah, well, and the benefits of using salt is pretty clear. It does prevent crashes on icy roads, improves public safety in the winter. So why should we lower our salt usage?
Right, so why should we go on a low salt diet? That's always the question. And ask your doctor that all the time.
It's not easy for anybody.
Right? So I think that make it absolutely clear that we're not talking about a decision of choosing between public safety and the environment. I just want to make that absolutely clear because that's not what we're talking about. What we're really talking about is the over-application of salt. The issue with salt is not necessarily the salt. It's the chlorides. So salt is sodium chloride. It's just regular table salt. That's what we put on our roads, rock salt. And the chloride part of it is toxic. It's toxic to fish, aquatic life. It's toxic to plants. You see the trees dead on the sides of the roads. It's toxic to our infrastructure. It starts to corrode our bridges. It damages our concrete. It causes the doors to become tarnished and eventually rust out. And our cars, corrosion on our cars is a major issue. And actually, I was looking at a report that's been a problem since 1957.
Well, has it gotten worse?
So what's gotten worse is that we're using a lot more salt than we used to. A lot more salt. If you look at trends in salt usage in the United States, they're dramatically different. We used almost no salt in 1940. And by the 1980s, we were using somewhere in excess of 10 million tons per year in this country. And by the early 2000s, we're using over 20 million tons nationwide on our roads.
But let's talk about the efficacy of
Sure.
using salt. How exactly does it work?
Right. So a lot of people, I think one of the biggest misconceptions about salt, and this is one of the things that we try to educate people on in our Green Snow Pro program. We're educating those people who are winter professionals, those people who lay down the salt during the winter. One of the biggest misconceptions is that you put the salt down and it works. It isn't quite how it works. Rock salt just sitting there on the ground does almost nothing. Rock salt doesn't really melt the ice until it's in solution.
Hmm.
So this is why when you're if the weather is 30 degrees or 20 degrees, rock salt works great because you put it down, it gets crushed up, there's friction, it warms, and it warms enough to go into solution, becomes salt water, becomes a brine. And when that happens, that's when it actually melts the ice.
How about when it's been super cold, you know, sub-zero like it was
right
at the beginning of this
so
month?
So rock salt does absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Zero. Almost nothing.
Really?
Below so, about 10 degrees.
But really, when you're driving behind a big salt truck on the road, right, you see it bouncing off of the road.
So a lot of that is just going to bounce right off. It's going to wash right off. But remember, there's cars, and they're creating friction. So that friction is what's heating the highway enough such that you can actually have the salt work. There are other chemicals, other magnesium chloride and other kinds of chlorides that do have a lower freezing temperature. And so they also are used sometimes when it's really cold. But what they really recommend when it gets really cold is you go back to sand for the traction control because there's really the ice isn't going to go anywhere.
Well, so are there municipalities using real brine, you know, like salt water?
Yeah. So one of the biggest innovations over the last 20 or 30 years is the use of brine. And so what they do is they create a solution. It's about 23% salt. And when you lay that down ahead of a storm, it sits there. And then when the storm comes, it actually does what salt is supposed to do. And what salt is most effective at isn't sort of melting the ice from the top. It's keeping the ice from connecting to the pavement.
Uh-huh.
And when you do that, it allows the plow to come by and scoop it right off without ice forming.
Huh.
And so the real advantages in brine are to keep that ice from ever adhering to the pavement itself so that the plow truck, which is that mechanical contraption, comes through and it actually just wipes that stuff right off and then everything is really nice. And so on our highways, a lot of times now, especially in the southern part of the state, they're using these brine trucks that put it down ahead of time. There's other advantages in that you can sort of wait longer in the storm before you have to start getting out there and dealing with it because you sort of have this invisible agent sitting there ready to separate the ice from the road before you're awake. So if the storm arrives at 4 a.m., maybe you don't have to get out till 5 or 6. That saves you an hour of labor. It saves you people having to get out of bed, wasting their night's sleep because you know that they're going to be up for the next 24 hours anyway.
Right.
So it's those kinds of issues that come up, as well as all of the problems that we have with too much salt in our water and the toxicity of salt. By using brine, it can reduce salt usage by 30 to 50%.
But how about the psychology of it, right? That we
right.
don't see the trucks out there on the road early in the morning.
Right. You don't. You don't. And I, you know, and that's one of the issues is perceptions. I think the most challenging issue related to salt reduction has nothing to do with technology or chemistry. It has to do with our perceptions. And there's a number of those. We don't expect salt is going to work unless we see it. Mm-hmm. Right. But the physics are such that if the ice is gone, you don't need more salt. If you can see it, it's not doing anything. So that's a public perception. We have the issues around slip and fall cases. So people are very worried, property owners very worried about a lawsuit because of a slip and fall. So they want to put extra salt down to make sure that they're covered. You've got the whole perception of the public that the streets should be dry and black under every circumstance, no matter what. You should be able to get to Walmart at 75 miles an hour, no matter what the weather. It's our God-given right as Americans. So, you know, I think that those are some of the public perceptions. And then there's, I think, the applicators themselves, the people who drive the plows. What we've seen is an increasing level of professionalism amongst those people. They're sharing information. They're improving their technology. They're experimenting with brine. They're experimenting with other liquids, an alternative to salt. And so there's a cadre of professionals. It's no longer two guys and a plow.
I've been reading things from Canada that say they're using cheese brine and beets.
Right.
What are these?
So there are a lot of experimentation. The reason why they're doing that is because when you use things like magnesium chloride, which is another one of those salts, it has a lower freezing point, which is nice during the really, really cold weather. But it has some real problems. One of the problems is it has twice the chloride. It also, under certain circumstances, becomes slippery. So they're looking for ways to have additives to that that can offset, and also things that have a low freezing point themselves. So yes, there's
high fructose corn syrup has been used, molasses, beer waste, distillery waste, cheese waste, beet waste. So there's all these different kinds of things that are now being used, these organics. Now, there are also other kinds of chemicals. Calcium magnesium acetate is one, CMA. I think that one really highlights some of the downsides to some of these alternatives that we have to look at. CMA is a chemical that if it gets into the water, it basically sucks out all of the oxygen.
Hmm.
It has what's called biological oxygen demand. So you don't want to use that near a sensitive lake, for example, because if it got into the water, it could really have a detrimental effects on the fish community, especially during the winter when they're already stressed.
So have you at DES run any of the numbers on these alternative solutions? You know, what it would cost not just to purchase them, but
right.
maybe to change the technology to distribute them.
So I don't think that there is a consensus out in the world as to what is the right technology and what is the right substance to be using instead of rock salt. Rock salt is going to be used for a long time. It's relatively cheap. Most of these other kinds of things, 2, 3, 4, 5 times more expensive than rock salt. And we already have stressed budgets in our agencies, in our municipalities. So that's a real challenge. And I don't think that there's a consensus on which one is the best or how best to apply it. So there's a lot of experimenting going on. I think where we are right now is we're seeing this kind of experimentation, lots of different things being tried. And until there's really, I think, good third-party analysis about the costs and the benefits, I think it'll be a while before we see wide implementation. But what I would do is encourage homeowners to experiment, because you can go right on Amazon and maybe even to your local store and find a beet juice ice remover. You can find a molasses ice remover. You can find these different kinds of products, and I encourage people to experiment with them a little bit. See what works. A lot of these things will certainly be better for your pet. They'll be better for your lawn, your landscaping, and they won't run off into the local stream and cause a problem. So I encourage people to experiment. I encourage people to experiment a little bit with brine. You know, mix up a little bit of brine in a spray bottle, but try to use less rock salt. Let's everybody try that.
Well, Ted Deers, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ted Deers is administrator for the Watershed Management Bureau at DES. He's also head of the Green Snowplow Certification Program. Stay with us. We've got a conversation with the alt-Latin musician and artist, Helado Negro, coming up right after the break. I'm Virginia Prescott with Word of Mouth from NHPR. In the summer of 2015, then-candidate Donald Trump accused Mexico of exporting rapists and criminals to the U.S. That same summer, Helado Negro's song, Young, Latin, and Proud, took off.
And you can only view you with what you got. You don't have to pretend that you've got no more. Cause you are young, Latin, and proud. Young, Latin, and proud.
That song became a kind of anthem for Latin Xers. But for Roberto Carlos Lang, the visual artist, musician, and alter ego of Helado Negro, the song was personal, introspective, and about identity, all hallmarks of his work. Rolling Stone says Helado Negro is among the 10 new artists that you need to know. So we're giving you a chance. Helado Negro is going to be at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth on Saturday, January 27th. And he's joining us now from a studio in New York. Welcome.
Hi.
So what should we call you? Helado Roberto what?
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, you can call me Roberto. That's fine.
I was really curious. Your parents, I guess, moved from Ecuador when they were just teenagers. Got that right?
Right. Yeah. My mother moved to New York from Ecuador when she was about 13. She moved to the West Side and different kind of place in the 60s, 70s. And my dad moved when he was a teenager to Hempstead in Long Island. And they became, you know, partners.
And you were raised, I guess, in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale?
I was, yeah. And so they moved, they honeymooned down there and loved it so much they stayed. And then I came to be.
So this was a largely Caribbean neighborhood. Were you sort of outliers, or were there other Ecuadorian families there?
I think it's like anything. You can live in New York and live in a community that's just a specific type of community, but have your friends, right? And I think it's the same kind of idea with a lot of immigrant families and communities. You get to where you're getting to, and you find the people that you want to associate yourself with. And I think in Florida, it's a lot easier to find a lot of people from Latin America. I mean, Miami, South Florida is the capital of Latin America. And so it was, even though whichever neighborhood we were in, we were always surrounded by mostly Ecuadorians and then a lot of other Latin American folks.
Mm. Well, let's hear one of your songs from the record Private Energy, your most recent album. This is called Calienta.
Calienta tu sonrisa. Miento que hace frío.
That's Calienta from Private Energy, from El Lado Negro, who I'm speaking with now. You sing in Spanish sometimes, sometimes in English, yeah?
I do.
Yeah, and I'm asking about it because there's this record that you did, Double Youth, and there's a lot of, like, question about identity. And I'm thinking about, you know, is there identity that feels more Spanish-speaking, more English-speaking, more El Lado Negro, more Roberto?
I think it ends up being a question that is external than more than it is internal, and if that makes sense. And what I mean by that is, like, I grew up speaking two languages. I grew up in a household, like most people in South Florida and a lot of people in immigrant communities that are growing up in the United States, I think. You have these dualities that exist. And for us, it's normal the way it is just all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in an external sense, like the second you move or leave your community or that kind of sphere that you were embraced by and raised by, you're starting to ask a ton of questions. You're like, oh, damn, I thought what was going on in my life was normal, but apparently it's way different everywhere else, right? And I know that sounds a little naive, but it's true. I think as a young person, you have, like, all these experiences that you feel are the most true to you. And then as you move around and realize how different things can be in, you know, just 100 miles away, it's kind of a wild phenomenon sometimes.
Well, and add another facet to you, you're also a visual artist, using
something
a lot
like
of found objects. So for you, is there a different kind of form of expression in your visual work than there is in your music?
I think it's all one thread for me, for sure. I think the live shows is supposed to be a kind of something that gets put together via the sound and the performance and what's happening visually via lights. And I have dancers that I work with locally in every city that wear these big, giant tinsel costumes that cover them completely, and they're called tinsel mammals. And it's a collaboration with my wife who makes them. And so there's like a lot of things that I'm crossing with performance are sourcing people locally to have a connection with, like, the local community in one respect, the creative community, and have that conversation with them somehow, or at least invite them to be there. Yeah, and also talk about how when someone hears this idea of this is Latin music, they remove this idea that there's timbales and congas in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And even remove this idea that it is Latin music. It's what we're identifying here, which is really important, I think, is that it is music from the United States. It is a product of what we are here.
Well, I've seen some videos of these dancers. They look like they're wearing these, like you said, they're tinsel mammals. There's kind of giant you know, Brillo Paddy kind of looking thing, shimmering in the light, right? But your songs are very shimmery. There's a kind of glowiness to them. What is it? What I read, one of the reviews said, his music is like snorkeling through the Milky Way. But I think it's also deeply romantic, right? You're kind of a crooner, or at least let's listen to a little bit. This is from Transmission Listen, one of your songs, unplugged here at a Tiny Desk concert for NPR.
So I'll sit up high and wait for you to blink. And I'm fond of you, but I don't believe you, and you lie to me, and I'll lie to you. And come caress me, 'cause you be gone. And come undress me, don't take too kindness that I want.
What do you think when you hear that? I mean, so often when you're performing, it's electronic music or your voice is kind of in the background or processed in some kind of way. That feels very pure to me.
Yeah. What's always been a focus for El Lado Negro as a musical project has always been that this exists as a song. And songs for me are sound art. I mean, songs are these very specific types of things that get built out of, you know, just air vibrations. And I think when things can be so simplistic and so stripped back and they can still exist like that and exist in many other like kinds of ways, I think it's really important and nice.
You've been a collaborator with a number of different musicians. It seems like it's one of the hallmarks of your work. Sufjan Stevens, famously. You also worked on the S-Town soundtrack from the series that Serial did. Can I ask how that happened? I mean, that must be something to get that call that you're going to do music for them or that they chose one of your songs.
Yeah, I think how it happens, it's very not the coolest thing. I mean, like, you just get an email.
It's not very exciting. It's not like being picked out of a live audience.
No, it's nothing like that. But the coolest aspect of that is that the music supervisor, he, you know, had been a fan and was just really interested in getting me involved. And I was one of four composers that was chosen. And, you know, they picked a few of my songs and they picked a few of someone else's songs. And it was cool. It was really cool to just be a part of the whole process. We worked on so much music and it just, a little bit of everything, you know?
So have you already identified people in Portsmouth who are going to be performing with you on stage as Tinsel Mammals?
I think we have, yeah. So we, the first year I did this in 2014, I did over like 80 shows with just volunteers. And then after that, I got a few commissions with a few different museums and began working with professional dancers. And so now we commission dancers locally. And I teach them all the choreography prior to the show. And they kind of receive these like FAQ instructional videos as well via email. And so there's a little pre-prep on their end. And then when they get there, it's not super intense, but there's like a lot of, I'm inviting people that I don't know to join me on stage to be a part of my performance that I've never met before. And we're kind of creating this rapport immediately. We're kind of just becoming friends. And it's kind of wild and amazing and kind of dangerous, but it's cool. It's worked, you know?
Well, we were looking forward to your shimmery presence here. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Roberto.
Thank you. I really appreciate all this time, you guys. I love you guys.
Roberto Carlos Lang. He's the visual artist and musician El Lado Negro. His new single is called Come Be Me, and you're going to hear it right now. He's going to be performing at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth on Saturday, January 27th. You can see videos of his work, including those fabulous tinsel dancers, hear more of his music, and find out about tickets for the January 27th show. All of that, wordofmouthradio.org. Feels right. Well, that is it for today. A special thanks to Jackie LeBlanc at the Vermont Agency of Transportation, Kevin Gutnick at the Minnesota DOT, and to Robert McFarlane. Extra special thanks to Ken Sheldon and his alter ego, Fred Marple, the unofficial ambassador of the fictional town of Frosties. Fred's got a number of theories about New Hampshire's particular vehicular menace.
I actually had a lady say, I don't know who this Frosties guy is, but I'm going to vote for him. He's got all these signs. He's a real go-getter.
Today's episode was produced by Justine Paradise with Taylor Quimby. Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Ben Henry are also on our production staff. Maureen McMurray is director of Sugar, Spice, and Just the Right Amount of Salt. Music from Ari De Niro, Blue Dot Sessions, and Poddington Bear. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.